"Give me a hand, Sapper," Nicholas invited, and started down the staircase. Yanni could not control his curiosity and handed over the controls to Fred. He followed the two Englishmen down to the lavatory on the main deck. Sapper and Yanni watched from the doorway as Nicholas took the Leatherman tool from his pocket and lifted the cover of the chemical toilet. Yanni grinned as Nicholas started to work on the screws, holding the hidden panel in place. Big Dolly was a smuggler's aircraft, and these little modifications were evidence of the pains that Yanni and Fred had taken to adapt her to that role. There were a number of these hidey-holes cunningly built into the engine housings and other parts of the fuselage. When they had flown back from Libya, the Hannibal bronzes had reposed in the secret compartment behind this panel. The location of the panel in the back of the toilet made it highly unlikely that any follower of Islam would want to investigate such an unclean area. "So that's what you were doing in here for so long," Yanni laughed as Nicholas lifted out the panel. His grin faded as Nicholas reached into the space beyond and carefully drew out an extraordinary object. "My God, what's that?" "The blue war crown of ancient Egypt," said Nicholas. He handed it to Sapper. "Lay it on the bunk, but treat it carefully." He reached into the compartment again. "And this is the Nemi's crown." He handed it to Yanni. "And this is the red and white crown of the two kingdoms. And this is the death mask of Pharaoh Mamoz. Last but not least, this is the Ushabti of the scribe Taita." The relics lay on the folded-down bunk, and they stood and stared at them reverently. "I've helped you bring out stone friezes and little bronze statues," said Yanni softly, "but nothing like this before." "But," Sapper shook his head, "the ammunition crates the Gippos offloaded at Aswan. What was in them?" 5 1-gallon bottles of chemical for the toilet," said Nicholas, "plus half a dozen spare oxygen cylinders, just to make up the weight." "You switched them," Sapper beamed at him. "But how the hell did you know that Royan was going to scupper us?" "She was right when she said I must have known she was no thief. The whole lark was out of character for her. She is," he searched for the correct description, "much too upright and honest. Not at all like the present company." "Thanks for the compliment," said Yanni dryly. "But she must have given you more reason than that to make you suspicious." "Yes, of course," Nicholas turned to him. "The first real inkling I had was when we came back from Ethiopia the first time, and she immediately pushed off to Cairo. I guessed she was up to something, but I was absolutely certain only when I learned that she had passed a message through Tessé to the Egyptian embassy in Addis. It was clear then that she had alerted them to our return flight." "The perfidious little bitch," Yanni guffawed. "Careful there," said Nicholas stiffly. "She is a decent, honest, and patriotic young woman. Warm-hearted and well, well, well." Yanni winked at Sapper. "Please excuse my slip." Only 2 of the great crowns of Egypt were set out on the polished walnut conference table. Nicholas had placed them on the heads of 2 genuine Roman marble busts that he had borrowed from a dealer with whom he did regular business here in Zurich. He had drawn the blinds over the 10th-story windows and arranged the lighting to show the crowns to the best effect. The private conference room that he had hired for the occasion was in the Bank Low building on Bahnhofstrasse. While he waited alone for the arrival of his invited guest, he reviewed his preparations and could find no fault with them. He went to the full-length mirror on one wall and tightened the knot of his old Sandhurst tie. The stitches had been removed from his chin. McNamara had done a first-rate job, and the scar was neat and clean. His suit had been made by his tailor in Savile Row, so it was in a muted chalk stripe, and had been worn enough to have acquired just the right degree of casual bagginess. The only shiny items of his dress were the handmade shoes from Lobb of St. James Street. The intercom buzzed softly, and Nicholas lifted the handset. "There is a Mr. Walsh to see you, Sir Nicholas," said the receptionist at the desk in the bank lobby downstairs. "Please ask him to come up." Nicholas opened the door at the first ring, and Walsh glowered at him from the threshold. "I hope you're not wasting my time, Harper. I've flown all the way from Fort Worth." It was only 30 hours since Nicholas had telephoned him at his ranch in Texas. Walsh must have jumped onto his executive jet almost immediately to have got here so soon. "Not Harper. Quentin Harper," said Nicholas.
"Okay, then, Quentin Harper. But cut the crap," Walsh said angrily. "What have you got for me?"
"I'm also delighted to see you again, Mr. Walsh," Nicholas stood aside. "Do come in." Walsh strode into the room. He was tall and round-shouldered, his jowls drooping and wrinkled and his nose beaky. With his hands clasped behind his back, he looked like a buzzard on a fence pole. Forbes magazine listed his net worth at $1.7 billion. Two men followed him into the room, and Nicholas recognized both of them. The antiquarian world was very small and incestuous. One of them was the professor of ancient history at Dallas University. Walsh had endowed the chair. The other was one of the most respected and knowledgeable antique dealers in the United States. Walsh stopped so suddenly that they both ran into him from behind, but he did not seem to notice.
"Son of a gun," he said softly, and his eyes lit with the flames of fanaticism. "Are those fakes?"
"As fake as the Hannibal bronzes and the Hammurabi bas-relief you bought from me," said Nicholas. Walsh approached the exhibits as though they were the cathedral communion plate, and he the archbishop.
"These must be fresh," he whispered. "Otherwise I would have known about them."
"Fresh out of the ground," Nicholas confirmed. "You are the first one to have seen them."
"Mammoths."
Walsh read the cartouche on the uraeus of the Nemi's crown.
"Then the rumours are true. You have opened a new tomb."
"If you can call nearly 4,000 years old new." Walsh and his advisers gathered around the table, pale and speechless with shock.
"Leave us, Harper," said Walsh. "I'll call you when I'm ready to talk to you again."
"Sir Nicholas," he prompted the American. Nicholas knew that he had the upper hand now.
"Please leave us, Sir Nicholas," Walsh pleaded.
An hour later, Nicholas sauntered back into the conference room. The three men were seated around the table as though they could not bear to be parted from the two great crowns. Walsh nodded at his minions, and they stood up and obediently but reluctantly filed from the room. As soon as the door closed, Walsh asked brusquely,
"How much?"
$15 million, Nicholas replied.
"That's 7.5 mil each."
"No, that's $15 million each. $30 million, the two of them." Walsh reeled in his chair.
"Are you crazy or something?"
"There are those who think so," Nicholas smiled.
"Split the difference," said Walsh. 22.5
Nicholas shook his head. "Not negotiable."
"Be reasonable, Harper."
"Reasonability has never been one of my vices. Sorry." Walsh stood up.
"I am so sorry, too. Perhaps next time, Harper."
He clasped his hands behind his back and stalked to the door. As he opened it, Nicholas called after him, "Mr. Walsh!" He turned back eagerly.
"Yes?"
"Next time you may call me Nicholas, and I shall call you Peter, as old friends."
"Is that all you have to say?"
"Of course. What else is there?" Nicholas looked puzzled.
"Damn you," said Walsh and came back to the table. He dropped into his chair. "Damn you to hell and back."
He sighed and pursed his lips and then asked,
"Okay, how do you want it?"
"Two irrevocable bank drafts, each for $15 million. Walsh picked up the intercom and spoke into it.
"Please ask Monsignor Montfleury, your chief accountant, to come up here," he ordered dolefully.
Nicholas sat at his desk in his study at Quentin Park. He stared at the panelling that covered the wall facing him. Although the panelling had originally come from one of the Catholic abbeys dissolved by Henry VIII in 1536, and had been bought by his grandfather almost 100 years ago, It was newly installed in this setting. He reached under the top of his desk and pressed the hidden button of the electronic control. A section of the panelling slid smoothly and silently aside to reveal the armoured plate glass of the display cabinet built into the wall behind it. At the same time, the spotlights in the ceiling lit automatically, and their beams fell on the contents of the cabinet. The spots had been placed so that there was no reflection from the glass window to distract the eye, and the beams brought out the full glory of the double crown and the golden death mask of Mamose. He poured whiskey into a crystal glass, and while he sipped it, he savoured the thrill of ownership. But after a while, he knew there was something missing. He picked up the Taita Ushabti from the desk in front of him, and spoke to it as though he was addressing the subject himself. "You knew the real meaning of loneliness, didn't you?" he asked softly. "You knew what it was like to love someone you could never have." He set down the statuette and picked up the telephone. He dialed an international number, and it rang three times before a man answered in Arabic. "This is the office of the Director of Antiquities. How may I help you?" "Is Dr. Al-Simmer available?" he asked in the same language. "Please hold the line. I'm putting you through." "Dr. Al-Simmer." Her voice sent an electric thrill down his spine. "Rayan," he said. And he could sense her shock in the long silence that followed. "You," she whispered. "I did not think I would ever hear from you again." "I just rang to congratulate you on your appointment." "You cheated me," she said. "You switched the contents of three of the crates." "As a wise man once said, friends are the easiest to cheat. They don't expect it." "You, of all people, should know the truth of that, Rayan." "You have sold them, of course. I have heard a rumour that Peter Walsh paid 20 million.
30 million, Nicholas corrected her. "But only for the blue and the nemis. Even as I speak to you, the red and white crown and the death mask repose before me."
"So now you can pay off your Lloyd's insurance losses. You must be very relieved."
"You won't believe this, but the Lloyd's syndicate, on which I am a name, has come up with much better results than were forecast. I wasn't really broke after all."
"As my mother would say, bully for you. Half of it has already gone to McNamara and Tessé. At least that is a good cause." Her tone tingled with hostility. "Is that all you called to tell me?" "No, there's something else that might amuse you. Your favourite author, Wilbur Smith, has agreed to write the story of our discovery of the tomb. He is calling the book The Seventh Scroll. It should be published early next year. I will send you a signed copy." "I hope he gets his facts straight this time," she said dryly. They were both silent for a while before Rayan broke in. "I have a mountain of work in front of me. Is there nothing else on your mind?" "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, there is." "Yes?" "I would like you to marry me." He heard her draw breath sharply. Then, after a long pause, she asked softly, "Why would you want anything so unlikely?" "Because I have come to realize how much I love you." She was silent again, and then she said in a small voice, "All right."
"What do you mean, all right?"
"I mean, all right, I will marry you."
"Why would you agree to anything so unlikely?" he asked.
"Because I have come to realize, despite everything, how much I love you back. There is an Air Egypt flight from Heathrow at 5:30 this afternoon. If I drive like fury, I may just make it. But it gets me into Cairo rather late. I will be waiting at the airport, no matter how late. I'm on my way."
Nicholas hung up and went to the door, but suddenly he turned back and picked up the Taita Ushabti from the desk. "Come on, you old rogue," he laughed triumphantly. "You're coming home as a wedding gift."